recording studio somewhere far, far away.
Merry White House Experience! Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Merry White House Experience, coming to you this week from the Fringe Club in Edinburgh. Now, I spent most of the festival downstairs at the Fringe Club playing the video trivia machine, but I think there must be something wrong with it. As I was just playing it, I was on a double or nothing, I was up for 10 quid, and the machine gave me this question. If all history is relative, there can be no such concept as being. Discuss. I'm David Baddiel, and this is Punt and Dennis. This week, the show is coming to you from Scotland, where, of course, the poll tax is already in operation. And we're here in Edinburgh, a city with a population of 38, according to the council. The BBC have sent us up here because we're right in the middle of the Edinburgh Festival, the original and best of the British arts festivals.
For those of you who don't know or haven't ever been to one, an arts festival is when they take the name of your town, stick the word festival after it, and get the Halle Orchestra, Peter Skellen, and a mime company from Afghanistan to perform in your local hall. Here in Edinburgh, it's rather more sophisticated than that. They get the Halle Orchestra, Peter Skellen, and a mime company from Afghanistan to perform in three different local halls.
Anyway, away from Edinburgh and off to the planet Neptune. The Voyager 2 spacecraft has been sending back pictures of it from 2.8 billion miles away. Scientists say the pictures took 4 hours to come back, which means you can get pictures back from Neptune faster than you can from TruePrint. And what's more, you don't get back 23 pictures of Neptune and one of some bloke you've never met. Posing in front of a hotel in Mallorca.
The photos showed that the planet Neptune has 400-mile-an-hour winds, thick cloud and sub-zero temperatures, which makes it climatically quite similar to Edinburgh.
The newspaper waxed lyrical over the pictures, and such was the awe at the sight that the Daily Mirror was moved to write, "This is the end of the age of innocence in space. We will never again see the major planets for the first time."
What this has mainly proved is that all the other planets in the solar system have better names than ours. Neptune, Jupiter, Saturn, Mars, Pluto,
Earth.
The others are all named after gods. Mars, god of war, Neptune, god of the sea, Venus, goddess of love, and Uranus, god of cheap innuendo. So why is our planet called such a crap name?
There was actually a little-known god called Earth, and he was the god of nice pullovers. Now that Voyager has been to Neptune, the next step could be a manned flight. However, Neptune is so big that apparently it only orbits the Sun once every 165 years, so a year there is 1,980 months long. This means that newspapers there are 6 weeks out of date as soon as they come out, and Wogan would be 82 and a half hours long instead of just seeming it. This would also make colonisation of the planet very difficult, although it would have the advantage that the Little and Large Christmas special would only be on once every 165 years. But on the other hand, every time you shaved, you'd have grown a full beard again by the time you'd finished, and the Daddy Longlegs would be renamed the Daddy Zimmerframe. Neptune is the only planet in the universe where you can go on for 2.5 weeks and still be accused of premature ejaculation.
Voyager is now heading out into the furthest reaches of deep space, and in another 12 years' time, it will have reached Venue 93. In case any alien civilization should ever find Voyager, scientists placed in it artifacts of humanity to help them understand life on Earth. Unfortunately, it was launched 12 years ago, so that if any extraterrestrials intercept it, they'll find a Silver Jubilee mug, a Bee Gees album, and videos of Blake 7.
Finally, back here in Edinburgh, we had some fine stand-up comedy from an Australian visitor, Rupert Murdoch, who made a speech in which he accused British television of
less than independent, muted journalism. I cannot imagine,
said Rupe,
a British Watergate or a British Iran gate being pursued by BBC or ITV with the vigour of the American networks.
Right, so what fearless investigative coup has been made by Murdoch's papers today?
Family doctor unlocks secrets of super sex.
Today's News of the World. Thank you.
And now the skint video experience.
There is a tradition in Irish folk music of rebel songs, but there's never actually been an English rebel song. Tonight's skint video presents you the first English cricket rebel song, brought to you by Mike Gatting and the boys from the White Stuff. And it goes like this.
As I was batting with Brodie, not intending to stay very long, I met with Ali Backhander, and he sang to me in his tempting song. A cheque he pulled out of his pocket, and he thrust it right into my hand. He said, come and help fight apartheid as a leader of our rebel band. You see, we need their diamonds, and we bow to the great Bougarand. With our shares and our major holdings tied up in their lovely white land. The papers question our motives. Can't they see that we're missionaries? They said if we beat the Springboks, that they would set Mandela free. But now this great moral crusade is not going according to plan. With Butcher and De Freitas refusing to play the white man. And now things don't look so rosy. The match sponsors are Mitchell End. They're putting a burning tie round my neck, and we'll play for the Ashes again. You see, we need their diamonds, and we bow to the great Bougarand. With our shares and our major holdings tied up in their lovely white land.
And now, part two in the Merry White House Experience's continuing series examining the present decline of British TV. Last week we looked at soap operas. This week, game shows.
Hello and welcome to Blockbusters. I'm Bob Holness. The first letter on the board is flashing, so fingers on the buzzers. What C am I?
The game show represents a particular symptom of developed capitalism in its obsession with prizes. The ultimate fetishization of the commodity, displayed most obviously in Sale of the Century and The Price is Right, but not so obviously in Bullseye, which displays only the ultimate fetishization of one particular luxury three-star caravan. This is the only prize on Bullseye, and no one ever wins it. If they did, they'd have to scrap the series. TV has, of course, seen intellectual game shows such as Mastermind, University Challenge, and Runaround. These consider themselves a breed apart from the normal run of game shows, but actually serve the same basic instinct.
Sir Balliol College, Oxford, the subject is Renaissance Art, your starter for 10. What C am I?
Channel 4's intellectual game show is Countdown, hosted by Richard Whiteley, a man who has shown that it's not what you know so much as how crap you are.
Right, so now it's Derek's turn.
Consonant, please.
J.
Consonant.
M.
Consonant.
T.
And another consonant.
D.
Consonant.
P. So that's five consonants now.
Right, okay. Consonant, please.
Consonant.
Yeah, all right. And another one.
I don't think you've quite understood, Derek.
But I was right. All seven were consonants.
Going back to the popular mainstream of game shows, one cannot overlook Blind Date. Blind Date is pillock propaganda. It disseminates the idea that the more of a pillock you are, the more likely you are to mate successfully. I wonder what Charles Darwin would have made of this.
1842, Galapagos Islands. My most recent research leads me to conclude that the species of male turtle who have been most successful in propagating the line are those who habitually form a conga and impersonate Bruce Forsyth.
And of course, Blind Date is simply not true. If it was a genuine reflection of one's real concerns when selecting a mate, it might look more like this.
Right, question for number one. How big's your knob?
Well, my love, nice to see you. To see you, 2 inches.
The only game show the BBC have ever had that came near Blind Date in ratings was Blankety Blank, which represented a singular high in game shows because of its music. We take you now to the house of its composer, Ronnie Hazelhurst, as he receives the brief for the new programme.
Well, Ronnie, the new programme's called Blankety Blank, and we're looking for a theme tune.
Right, well, obviously I'll have to give that some thought. Right, what about this? Blankety blank. Blankety blank.
Right, yeah, and what's the tune?
That was it.
I see. Oh, okay. Now, there's also a bit in the programme which is called Supermatch Game.
Ooh. Well, that's a toughie. That's a toughie. Let me see. Well, I have been listening to a lot of Gershwin recently. So what about this? Supermatch Game. Supermatch Game. That'll be £500,000.
Yeah. It's very clever. It's very clever. I wonder if it just needs something else, perhaps at the end.
All right, then. Supermatch Game. Call it another 20 grand, see yourself out.
Well, hello and welcome to the Agony Aunt Experience, in which I sort out a few problems for people. And first, I've got a tragic letter from Weekend magazine. Dear David, I am a policeman, and after an affair with a WPC, I have developed a painful swelling of the testicle. Good. And now a problem from Women's Weekly. Obviously a magazine read only by spinster Sunday school teachers. There's no hint anywhere in the magazine that people are violent, have sex, or go to the toilet. But the cardinal sin within this magazine appears to be burning a batch of drop scones, for which the penalty is death. Most problems in Women's Weekly are actually to do with wedding etiquette, but I found this slightly different problem. Dear Mary, I'm 53, single, and childless. Should I hurry up and register with a marriage bureau before it's too late? Well, lonely lady from the South, I don't know if you've heard of the menopause or not. I think it probably is too late already, isn't it? And considering the angel Gabriel hasn't made it down to your part of Surrey for a bunk-up yet, I think maybe you should consider a marriage bureau. I wouldn't recommend them personally. Full of perverts, sexually inadequate, and people that look like Paul Daniels. Problem is, are there any other ways to meet men? Well, not if you read Cosmopolitan magazine. They have a whole page devoted to a problem each week known as On the Couch with Uncle Tom. Tom is a psychologist and answers Cosmo readers' angst-ridden dilemmas. There's a picture of him at the top of the page, sitting on the couch, waiting to sort your problem out. I'd like to make 2 points here. Firstly, Tom looks like a medieval sex offender. And secondly, I'd rather get on the couch with a donkey. I noticed that at the bottom of the page there were some phone lines for people with problems, so you can phone Tom up and ask about how to keep your man, or how to tell him what you like in bed. I thought I'd ring up the how to talk to a man line. That sounded rather interesting and was in fact very enlightening. Apparently when you meet a man, it's important to tell him your name and ask him his. I suppose this is just in case it's Jeffrey Archer and you have to call a cab rather quickly. I'm off to see Uncle Tom now and give him a good kicking in the ghoulies. Then I can phone him up and ask him what he likes in bed.
How many people here, how many of you have seen Batman? Yeah, and how many of you thought it was crap? Why are people flocking to see a film about a man who is so obsessed with crime that he dresses up as a winged rodent and keeps his car in a cave? The answer can be summed up in one word.
Hype.
Things have always had to be hyped. Even things that nowadays we take totally for granted have at one time or another been totally new to the public.
Say, Bob, this apple just hit me on the head.
Well, that's right, Isaac. That's because it has no gravity.
Gravity from a massive planetary body near you.
Gee, Bob, I can cut my food up just fine, but it's so messy getting it in my mouth.
I used to have that problem too, Joe. But now there's new fork.
Fork?
That's right. No more messy fingers misery, Joe.
Four prongs and a handle, a fork will spear your food.
Gee, Bob, it sure is painful having your legs sawn off.
I used to find amputations a bit sticky too, Joe. Until I discovered Anesthetics.
Anesthetics?
Anesthetics, that's right. You can remove any limb you want and you won't feel a thing.
Sleep like a baby while we amputate your limb.
Bone.
Now, not all products that have been hyped have been so useful to humanity, however. In fact, generally speaking, the more useful the product, the less hype you need. The real hard sell comes with those useless, crappy products that you don't need at all. Loads of people actually bought the buttoneer, the brush-o-matic, and the record rack where you tip the first record forward and all the rest followed automatically. And games like Haunted House, Battling Top.
It's all in the wrist action.
And they should know. And... and Buckaroo. Buckaroo. How on earth did they ever manage to persuade us to buy that one?
Okay, right. We've thought of this brilliant new game for all the family.
Yeah, what do you have to do?
Well, you've got a plastic mule on a spring,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And you take it in turns to put little buckets and pickaxes on the mule.
Right, yeah.
Until at some point the mule springs up and all the bits fall off.
Sounds fantastic.
So, what do we call it?
How about Plastic Mule on a Spring?
One. In the 1980s, of course, hype has entered all areas of life. Hype is what convinces us that we want to buy a watch that's water resistant to 60 fathoms when the most we're likely to do with it is doggy paddle a width across the municipal swimming pool.
Hype is the reason that we want a car that looks good parked in a drive of a country mansion when we live in a semi-detached in Croydon.
Hype is what is currently telling us that lead-free petrol is doing the environment good when in fact it's doing it fractionally less harm.
And it's hype that's currently trying to convince us to buy shares in our own water supply.
Now, the water industry has actually announced yesterday that the advertising campaign that they've run was in no way related to privatisation. A spokesman for the industry was quoted in yesterday's papers saying,
The advertising has coincided with the privatisation only because the privatisation is happening.
And a spokesman for the Mary White House Experience replies, bollocks.
And now the character assassination experience. This week, Her Royal Highness, Her Majesty, the Queen.
The Queen was born in 1927 on the 3rd of March. She was born again on the 7th of September. Unfortunately, the midwife only turned up on her official birthday, when she had already been born.
Come on, ma'am, lie on your back and put your feet in the stirrups.
No, no, that's how I got pregnant in the first place.
What would the Queen do if she wasn't the Queen? After all, she's got no qualifications, no experience, and no dress sense. So, presumably she's about to be signed up by Stock, Aitken and Waterman. All she's got, in fact, is a good speaking voice.
The Queen now standing on platform 4 is for first class marshal of the facility at M. Kittering.
This could, of course, be put to other uses.
Socialist worker! Socialist worker!
Or perhaps a telephone job.
Hello, caller. My name is Luscious Lewis, and I'm into Bubba.
After all, in certain jobs, all you need is a voice.
Here's John Barnes down the line, crossing it in once more, finds the head of Beardsley. Barnes! That'll do! And surely now the trophy is on its way to Enfield. And what do you make of that, President's calendar of Zambia?
But there are some jobs her voice simply wouldn't be suited to.
Now, I'm not asking £10. I'm not asking £9. No, no, put your money away, ladies. As I always say, I've never been to prison and I don't want to get back again. I'm talking silly money. £2.50. Thank you very much, sir. There you are, the crown jewels.
The Queen does, however, have her critics. It is said by some that she fulfills no useful function and that she is a parasitic, sour-faced, lazy, bloody, fat cow. However, such critics forget what a vital role she played in boosting troop morale during the war. One old soldier recalls the profound effect her wartime speeches had on him.
As head of the Waffen-SS, I'm convinced her speeches were a major contribution to the fall of Poland.
Princess Michael of Kent there. But of course, as people always say, the Queen does have a very difficult job. But people also always say, better out than in. But there are many situations which, for the Queen, are much more difficult than for the ordinary person. Top of these is singing the national anthem.
Go
Another thing is that every year she has to give a Christmas message, but she can't act anything like the way that one always feels straight after Christmas lunch.
Hello. Sorry. One is a bit pissed. Now, let me have a look at my piece of paper. Why did the germ rule? Because it saw the apple turnover. Better afternoon.
Hello, everyone. My name's Mark, and this is the bit of the show where I discuss the topic of the week, and then I'll come amongst you and get your opinions on what we've been talking about. What struck me quite a lot is that the government have recently put a whole load of money into community care for the mentally ill, with a big recruitment drive for the armed forces, which kind of like, those people, the armed forces, have got to classify as mentally ill. The weird thing is, I think that people who join the army are quite normal when they go in. But they turn them round, turn them into machines, sort of like drilling and parading. And if you ask someone, why do you drill soldiers or why do you parade soldiers? And they say, well, we parade them so that we can teach them self-discipline. Which is stupid, because they parade them to get them to follow orders. If they really wanted to teach them self-discipline, they'd have all the soldiers meditating. Out on the parade ground, lotus position! You'd have the Edinburgh tattoos, and now the Queen's Own Shatsu massagers. Being led out. It'd be great. Trooping of the colour, there'd be the Coldstream Guard in orange going, hurry, 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 Krishna. It's just lovely. That's really Goose Green in the Falklands, the Paras would be going over to the Argentinians. Come in for a tarot reading, man. Come on. And then you get a little announcement on the news. Police fought pitched battles with hippies and paratroopers trying to gain access to Stonehenge. Oh, man. The weirdest thing is, though, the army must classify as the most reactionary institution ever. Like, makes Mussolini look quite liberal. But that's nearly the only nationalised industry we've got left. Like, all the others are being flogged off. And in the Sunday Observer, they're talking about privatising the manufacture of nuclear warheads. What's going on there? You're going to sort of like get them down the market soon. Oh, Polaris, Cruise, go on, try them, we got them here. It's all right, fell off the back of a launcher, know what I mean, mate? You'll apply for your shares and 2 weeks later this lead-lined envelope comes through, you know? But I don't like the nuclear stuff because people say that nuclear weapons have kept the peace for 40 years. Well, apart from Vietnam, Korea, Ireland, Falklands, Suez, Cyprus, Afghanistan, El Salvador, Grenada, Honduras, Cuba, Chile, Lebanon, West Bank, Iran, Iraq, Algiers, Namibia, Angola, Zimbabwe, Libya, Spain and Hungary and Thailand, it's worked a treat. Yeah, isn't it? I think the weirdest excuse you get for the army is you get sort of people going, if we didn't have the army, Russia would invade us like a shot. What for? Oh, you see, we've got lots of things that old Johnny Russia wants. Oh, I see. I bet all the Politburo are sitting in the Kremlin flicking through the new Argos catalogue right now. They're just sitting there waiting. We must invade Britain for bread, peace and Snoopy lunchboxes. I think the other thing, I mean, like, as far as I'm concerned, I hope that one day we won't have to have wars and kill people and that any sort of disputes will be settled with games, like Scrabble. I think that'd be brilliant on the news. Today, the troops from Britain were withdrawn from Ireland after Gerry Adams got a 7-letter word on a double scorecard. And Margaret Thatcher is contesting it in the European Human Rights Courts, saying that crew cut is a hyphenated word. So anyway, we're going to come in and ask some questions. Okay, did you think we need an armed forces?
Yes, I do.
Why's that?
To protect us from people like you.
To protect us?
And now it's time for the punchline experience. Before the show, the studio audience here in Edinburgh are asked to come up with a funny and imaginative punchline for the following joke. What were Mrs. Rushdie's parting words to her husband? I've got all the answers on bits of paper here in my hand, and the best one will win a prize. A copy of the Satanic Verses, which you have to pick up from W.A. Smith's in Bradford. So here we go. What were Mrs. Rushdie's parting words to her husband? No, sorry, I don't think a second honeymoon in Tehran will do us any good. Yes, that's from the Teenage Mutant Ninja Social Workers, apparently, or as he's otherwise known, Sad Bastard Without Any Friends. What were Mrs. Rushdie's parting words to her husband? Now, why should I want to tell them your address? All right. That's from just Grant, because he's a bit of a hard lad, I presume, and only has one name.
I'm just going next door to borrow some coffee. That's from Joan Sherry, who I think is implying that Mrs. Rushdie is the woman from the Gold Blend advert, in which case she should get shot as well, as far as I'm concerned. Goodbye, dear. Yes, that's from Gavin Slater, who has misunderstood the whole concept of comedy. You should have called it Fly Fishing by J.R. Hartley. How to get a round of applause in three easy lessons. See, Mum, I told you I'd get a mention on the radio. That's from Shelley Waterson, and we're going to cut that one out later. Oh, darling, how's about one last shag before you get taken away into hiding at the back of Azad Video in the Haymarket? That's from David Thompson. I think that one wins. So the copy of Satanic Verses goes to David Thompson. A big round of applause for him, ladies and gentlemen.
And now, Mary Whitehouse Productions presents The Day the Earth Turned Stupid, starring Tom Cruise, Mel Gibson, and me, Wendy Craig.
Britain, 1990. The build-up of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere due to the greenhouse effect has cut off supplies of oxygen to the brain so much that the average IQ now stands at 45, an increase of 22 for Samantha Fox. But stupidity has been building up for some time. The human brain has been softened through decades of pollution, centuries of bad diet, and 2 months of Michael Barrymore's Saturday Night Out. Throughout the 80s, the evidence of stupidity was mounting.
I got a great idea for this new movie. It's going to be called Ishtar.
Well, as head of the selection committee, I can see no better man for the job than Bobby Robson.
Oh, I'll tell you what, let's call it the Social Liberal Democrats.
So, Mr. Dodd, in view of the evidence, case dismissed.
But soon it became apparent that things were getting worse when in a shock cabinet reshuffle, the new Prime Minister was announced as Michael Jackson. Meanwhile, newsreaders all over the world conveyed the growing scale of the crisis.
Now, an exclusive live satellite link with President Bush. To discuss the crisis is our political correspondent, Philip Schofield.
Hello, Mr. President. Well, now, we're very pleased to have you with us at this very difficult time. And first, what I'd like to ask you is, what prize have you brought along for our competition?
Well, the prize I'd like to offer all the kids watching, because the guy who's got it at the moment is a bit old for it now, is the job of Vice President. And by the way, Philip, tell Sarah I'm sorry that we shot down her helicopter. We thought it was an Airbus.
Just when it seemed that there was no hope left, a dramatic turnaround occurred. All the people who were previously stupid suddenly became quite intelligent. However, for some people, the self-realization which accompanied this new intelligence proved just too much to bear.
Well, now then. What a crap thing that is to say once, let alone 100,000 times in front of millions of people. Now, how's about that, then? Oh, God, I'm such an asshole.
Will humankind survive? It's up to you. And now, back to Wendy.
Oh, no. I've burnt the Sunday roast.
And now, Ronnie Corbett.
You've been listening to the Mary Whitehouse Experience. It was written and performed by David Baddiel, Rob Newman, Steve Punch, Hugh Dennis, Matt Thomas, Joe Brand, and Skid Video. The production assistant was Barbara Keir. The sound was by Roger Dent. And the producer said to me, Ronnie, he said, as he does, Ronnie. And his producer said to Ronnie, and the producer was, in fact, Bill Dent. Thank you, good night.